Hello, and welcome to my podcast called Adventures on the Can-Do. I am your host, Jothi Rosenberg, a.k.a. The Incorrigible Entrepreneur. A professor turned entrepreneur and founder of 9 companies, on this show, I talk with business leaders and personal achievers. Adventures on the Can-Do explores the challenges and rewards of entrepreneurship, overcoming adversity, and where grit and perseverance can get you. Be inspired by others. And push yourself along your path to success and fulfillment. I wrote a book called Think Like a Startup Founder based on my experiences, good and bad, to try to help early stage startup founders avoid the oh so many potential pitfalls founders can experience by hearing my firsthand stories of what happened to me. With this podcast, I'm adding to that the stories of many other founders, each with an amazing story and set of lessons learned that will be valuable to listeners. Before we jump into today's episode, just a reminder of how you can support this podcast. You can go to my website, jothirosenberg.com, and sign up for my newsletter, and there you can see other episodes of this podcast. Also, please follow us on one of the many social media channels we post on. And with all that behind us, let me introduce our guest on today's episode, Michael Peterson. Michael is a distinguished founder, engineer, and CXO who is recognized as a visionary global high-tech product and marketing executive. His expertise lies in turning innovative ideas into profitable ventures. Currently leading Raise a Hood, Peterson is spearheading the transformation of the automotive repair industry. His startup synergizes crowdsourced insights, expert guidance, and machine learning to vastly improve vehicle maintenance for consumers and independent shops. A notable achievement is the creation of Gus, a patent-pending AI engine that blends traditional machine learning with the wisdom of veteran mechanics. Peterson's impressive career trajectory includes influential roles at Ford Motor Company, Dell Computer, Motorola Solutions, and Zebra Technologies, contributing significantly in the fields of engineering, product design, and product management. He holds an MBA from the University of Michigan, an MS in automotive engineering from Purdue, and a bachelor's in mechanical engineering from the University of Minnesota. An individual of diverse interests, Peterson is passionate about teaching car racing and adventure motorcycle riding. His active involvement in communities and nonprofit organizations highlights his dynamic, all-encompassing approach to leadership and innovation. And here's Michael Peterson. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Jothi. How are you?
I'm good.
I've been looking forward to today's conversation.
Okay, me too. Every single person I'm meeting who's a startup founder their stories are so different. It's just fantastic. And yours is different. In a lot of ways, which we're going to get into. So I see that you have a little banner for Raise a Hood. You probably had to create that for some conference or show or something. Tell us what prompted you to create Raise a Hood. I mean, you must have seen some big problem in the market.
Well, I think yes. My many years ago, my father was a mechanic when I was young. And so that instilled this gasoline in my veins. And that was ultimately why I went to undergraduate school and I went to grad school and at least in engineering. It sent me to Ford for 7 or 8 years and I really enjoyed it. Ultimately, after B school, I went into high tech. And I went into high tech because it was moving a lot faster and it just seemed more exciting and, more change. And the automotive industry was a little stagnated. And after spending a modestly successful career, I think, in high tech, I still enjoyed the automotive sector, but it was changing very rapidly. And when you started to drill into the automotive sector, the one remaining area, there was all this focus on next generation stuff, and it's exciting. Driverless vehicles, electric vehicles, advanced hybrid vehicles, some modern tech in cars, it's really quite amazing. However, all of that is focused on the 2% of people per year that actually can afford to buy a new car. right? So people dream about this stuff, but it doesn't really impact their life, at least in the near term. The majority of people are driving used vehicles that are out of warranty, and they're just trying to get to work on Tuesday. And when you start to drill down into this sort of this automotive journey with most customers and average Americans, they're frustrated with just the high cost of maintenance and repair of vehicle ownership as a whole. And when they start going to a shop, they realize that there's a high level of distrust. And it doesn't mean all shops are bad, quite the contrary. But those shops are holding all this asymmetric information. They fundamentally know what's broken, what the likely repair cost is. And we learn that when you start drilling into that, 25% of the shops out there are awesome. They're really, really good. 30% of the shops out there, they're perfectly fine. About half of the shops out there is a great proof point that there's low barriers to entry of, you know, opening a shop. So the question is, how can we stitch together the very best shops out there, arm the customers with the right relevant information so they can make better decisions where they're going to a shop or whether they're doing it themselves, and ultimately drive down the cost of vehicle ownership for everybody. And so that sounds great at 30,000 feet. The challenge is to do that is hard because there's so many different makes and models and problems and powertrain configurations and trim configurations that it's not like I just have to go build Uber and I have one app and I hire some drivers and I'm off to the races. You know, this is a fundamentally more complicated problem to solve. But it will get solved. It will get disintermediated. I'm empathetic to the dealerships because the dealerships are, you know, the dealerships now make more money on their service bays than they do on new cars and used cars combined. So when you go to the dealership to get work done on your vehicle and you feel a little anxious because you think it's going to be expensive, it's going to be expensive because they need those dollars just to keep their business afloat, right? Because that's not a very efficient business model in many respects. So the question is, can we use technology to go, you know, to fix all of this? I think your question was, hey, why did you jump into this? And my response would be because it's a fascinating problem. And I frankly don't think there's a lot of people in this world that are well equipped to tackle it. I have at least the, you know, the chops from a tech perspective. I have the chops from an engineering perspective. I have, you know, enough commercial leadership. Like, okay, don't be a wimp. Jump in and give it a shot, right? Stop complaining about the system and do something about it.
You know, it does seem to me that if you want to find a great restaurant, you've got a lot of resources to do it. If you want to find, the best place to go on a trip, there's a lot of resources to do it. But as you were talking, I was thinking, well, other than just looking at ratings that are sort of pretty random, you don't really know which are the good repair shops. And it's obviously a really big deal. You own an older car. And
when you say older car, what's interesting, when you say older car, that's the average car to the normal American. The average car in the US, the average car is almost 13 years old. So if you are driving a 13-year-old car, you're driving a normal car. Mm-hmm. Where I think most of us, especially in tech and, you know, professional, oftentimes they drive newer vehicles. And I meet a lot of people, they buy a new car every 3 years just so it never goes out of warranty. But they don't recognize that's a million miles away from the way the average American lives.
Yeah, I get it. I try to keep a car, if I can, 6 years.
So when you sell that car after 6 years, the person that's picking it up is like, wow, I have practically a brand new vehicle.
Well, I mean, you're right about high tech people, because I'm always jealous of, like, somebody's telling me about my car has these cool new features. And it's like, oh, rats. I didn't get those features in my car. But I can't stand the idea of only keeping a car for 2 or 3 years. I just think that's not. That's somewhat wasteful. Okay. Pretty good. Very good. Description, motivation for the problem and your ability to apply technology to help solve it. So tell us about, you know, this company itself. So what stage is it at? How are you funding it?
Yeah, good question. And so we founded this company, Razorhood, and the intent is to disintermediate the overall ecosystem. It's going to take time. We recognize this is not a get-rich-quick scheme by any sense of the imagination, because there's some fundamental things that we're trying to overcome. We founded the company in 2021. We did our first round through primarily angel investors. And that was fairly easy to go do. And we've been running on that for a couple of years. We're going through a seed round right now. So if there's any listeners out there that are interested in a seed round, we're doing a raise of about $2.5 million right now to put it back into the business.
And can I interrupt you for just a second? I wanted to ask, was the angel round a bridge or was it a priced round?
It was convertible notes.
Okay, and so it's going to convert to the seed.
It's going to convert at the seed, exactly.
Okay.
And as you know, most convertible notes and safe notes, they're virtually identical in many ways. But effectively, it's a very common way on a pre-seed to go price it, because what's the company worth? Well, nobody knows, right?
Yeah,
it's
right.
Too young. And so yeah. You can do it against convertible notes. And that way, it's a win-win for everybody. They get a very fair value, and you just kind of de-risk the investment for everyone.
What kind of discount did you give them on the seed price?
You know, on that one, the notes were at a 20% discount. And I can't remember if we used a 5% or 6% interest rate against that, but it was a very, you know,
that's standard. Yeah, but those are kind of standard terms.
They're kind of standard numbers. And quite frankly, I'm of this belief that, you know, I think a lot of these pre-seed numbers, they'll end up at 15 to 20 and we erred on the higher side. If somebody's willing to throw capital into this thing at the very earliest stage, give them the benefit of a doubt.
Yeah.
Because they're taking a higher risk. So.
Yeah, no, I get it. I mean, I did a lot of angel investing convertible notes for my current one and previous ones, but especially this one.
Yeah, and it seems to be just the cleanest way to go through that stage. And then the seed round that we're going through right now is a traditional priced seed round without a lot of covenants associated with that. It's just traditional
seed
round.
And you don't have a lead investor for that yet, do you?
Yes and no. I think it really, as you go through these seed rounds, you're trying to figure out, ours depends on the size of the raise. And so if we have a very clear lead, if it's a slightly smaller round, if we start to go after a slightly larger round, then we don't have as clean of a lead, although we have a couple of good candidates. What's interesting right now, and I'm sure a couple of people that are listening to this, are, you know, well-versed in the startup structure, is the markets are still a little bit apprehensive right now on funding. And if we were trying to fund this 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I think it would have been very easy. But I think right now there's a lot of people on the sidelines and they're taking more conservative approaches to some of their investments, which I respect and I understand. And ours is still, we have early revenue, but not meaningful revenue. And so there's just a little bit more risk associated with that, which means that in terms of your fundraising, you know, you're dinged accordingly, which I understand.
Now, do you have a minimum viable product at this point?
Yep. We've been out in market since middle of last year in a B2C model. And so I think what's interesting, and this is probably, you know, something worthy of passing on, Jadi, when we did a bunch of market research before we built this business, and we kind of tested the key hypothesis of are people willing to pay for good guidance to save money. And the numbers came back when we were looking at the 200 million people in the U.S. driving cars out of warranty, is when you interview them and you say, hey, would you be willing to give us $20 for, you know, such and such to go save you $1,000 on your next repair bill? Everybody says, not everybody. 80% of them said, yes, I would pay for artificial intelligence to help me. I would pay for telemechanics to help me. I would absolutely pay for that service, right? 80% times 200 million people is a nice market size, right? And so we launched it. Now, one of the biggest issues, though, in going, because ours is a SaaS business, software as a service model, in a B2C space, business to consumer. Consumers, they will tell you on a survey that I'll give you, you know, 80% of them will give you $20 for whatever it may be. But when you go online and you say, okay, we'll give you the answer, it's $20. You're like, whoa, 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 wait a minute here. You mean I have to pay for this? Everything online is free, right? All information online is free. That's the way the internet works, right? And so there's this perception that if it's online, it's free. And so we kind of knew that going into it. And guess what? We built our B2C business and launched it, and we proved ourselves right that it's hard to get customers to extract money online for SaaS-based products. And so our revenue was good, but it wasn't enough where you look at that and you go, this is going to be the next unicorn. So we have B2B was always part of our core portfolio, I mean, strategy. But we have said, okay, let's accelerate the B2B side of it. And so once I know, though, Jothi, that you drive, and you told me what you drive, and I can't remember what it was. What
kind of car? I'm driving a Kia. EV.
And so once I know, though, Jothi, that you drive this 2020 Kia EV XYZ and it's acting up in this manner, that piece of information becomes highly valuable. It's highly valuable to independent shops. It's highly valuable to other dealerships. It's highly valuable to insurance providers. It's highly valuable to part sellers. It's high, you know, that in and of itself is really an expensive asset. And so then we can go and monetize that information in a variety of different ways. Now, we're still helping the customer in the same way. And it's free now for people in, you know, in our launch zones and our launch zip codes. But we monetize it in other ways from B2B. It is exactly like the Google model. Like, I suspect you've used Google three times this morning. And you did not have to break out your credit card once to use Google. Now, you know darn well that some of that information is being used in other ways. And you accept that. Ours is a similar model. We're going to give you away all this great information. We'll even give you one-on-one phone calls, you know, telemechanic support, but we're going to monetize it in other ways because we still have to have a functional P&L at the end of the day.
So, all right. So you've got this, by the way, how many people are you employing at this point?
Well, there's only a few of us that are working on this full time, but it's like a lot of startups. You just don't have the capital to say, we're going to go hire 30 people. And so a lot of people that work on this are 1099 employees, part-time employees. You're trying to pull together the necessary skill sets to get the flywheel spinning so you can onboard more significant teams. So if you Sure. look at it and say, how many people are actually employed by this right now, not just as a full-time employee, but through the, you know, sort of ecosystem of 1099s and contractors and everything else, we probably have anywhere from 10 to 30 people employed on this on any given day.
And you're, I forgot to ask my favorite question at the very beginning, which everybody loves to know, which is, where are you located?
I am located outside of Minneapolis on the west side of town.
Okay. So, you know, good, solid, you know, Midwestern kind of stock. Yep. And so when you talk to potential seed investors, and I assume you're considering a mix of institutional, you know, traditional VCs and maybe a strategic. I know it's it's not common to put a strategic in a seed investment. But when it's something this, you know, that's sort of deeply immersed in one industry, it might make sense. I actually put a seed investor, a strategic in my seed investment, which was considered a little unusual in the space that we're in. So I'm wondering if you are finding that there's, you know, a significant crop of VCs for you to look at that are relatively close to where you are, because VCs don't like to fly. They like to be able to you know, to have a board meeting and visit you. Those West Coast people, they especially don't like to fly anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a couple of questions in there to unpack. Let me talk about the first one, about the strategics on the investors. And we have one strategic right now that, there's a number that we're speaking to in this sector. strategics, two or three of them. And one of them is really exciting, and I can't say anything, but it would be a name that everybody would recognize for kind of the same reasons that you outlined. And quite frankly, companies of that caliber probably don't invest in seed offerings very often. We'll see how it plays out. It would be great to have them on the cap table. I think the fact of the matter is, when you think about the buying opportunity, though, from investors, is if you're a traditional investor that's buying companies post-revenue to de-risk the system, which is where a lot of these strategics are, right? They're not getting into these deals super early. They're saying, okay, let's get some revenue behind it and, you know, de-risk this thing a little bit because we know what the profitability could look like at one point in time. They're still less inclined to invest on the seed round very early in the deal, unless they see something sort of unique and special here. And so the fact that we're picking up some of the interest in that area, I think, is exciting. But I think right now also, if you look at the overall ecosystem, there's some hesitancy about buying companies at the very early stage. They're all trying to de-risk. It's like you going out to buy a new, if you're going to go buy a new, some new clothing, right? And you're going to go buy a new ski coat, right? I know you ski, Jothi, right?
Yeah.
Different than other people, but you ski. If you're going to go buy a ski coat, you might look at 10 different ski coats, right? But you're still going to say, okay, of those 10, I'm going to buy the one that represents the best value for my dollar right now. And I think the same thing happens in some of these VCs. Now, they're not buying one ski coat. They might be buying 10 ski coats, but they're still looking at the 10 ski coats of the lot of 50, and they're trying to de-risk some of those investments as much as possible. And right now, as we start to climb out of kind of this softness that we all experienced in the investment community in the VC space, they're still a little bit more conservative, I think, on some of their investments when it comes to these seed companies.
Mm-hmm. They certainly are.
My experience.
Yep. No, I agree. But I don't have the experience of being in the Midwest and trying to raise money. So I don't know basically anything about the VCs. And I can tell you all kinds of things about the differences between East Coast VCs and West Coast VCs. But I don't know much about the middle part of the country and how that investment community is behaving. And is it worth it to you to make sure that you're including in the mix East and West Coast VCs as you start the pitching?
We are including VCs, and we're less geo interested right now than we are in terms of specialty to ensure that they're looking at, we want people that have some mobility expertise in general. Now, we'll look at just about anybody. Obviously, if people come to us and say, hey, I love what you guys are up to, I'd like to, have that conversation, we'll certainly entertain it. But when we actually look into the VCs, you start to say, well, what are the VCs that play in this space in general? What are the VCs that have been active, in the last 24 or 36 months? There's a lot of ghost funds out there, as we know, where they'll talk to you, but they're not placing any bets right now because they don't have any free capital to work with. And so we try to be fairly strategic in who we reach out to and how. And we are not being, geo-constrained. I have found that some of the VCs, and I don't want to say all of the Midwest, but I think some of the VCs, specifically in the Minneapolis area, are really quite risk-averse. And that's fine. If you look at the DNA of the personalities in our area, this is a great stat about startups that somebody else told me, but I'll share it, and assuming that it was accurate because it came from a very reputable source. If you look at the number of startups, and it's really measured as new businesses in the state of Minnesota, one of the key metrics, the KPIs, is you can say, well, how many new businesses are startup per capita? Like if there's 1 million people out there, how many new businesses come per capita? Where do you think Minnesota ranks in the terms of number of new businesses per capita out of the 50 states?
I would just guess 10th.
We're 49th.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I think the only person that's worse than us, I think, is Mississippi or something. I can't remember. We suck at new businesses.
Oh, wow.
We're a bunch of conservative Swedes that came out of the farm community that just kind of roll up our sleeves and get it done. There's not a very vibrant startup community here yet. Now, we're doing a lot of things to try to change that, but we really suck as a state in terms of just people having the guts or stupidity like me to say, okay, we're going to go build something unique.
It's probably both guts and stupidity.
Guts and stupidity. Yeah, exactly. When you flip that though, and you say, okay, for all the new businesses that were started, how many of them have survived 5 years in?
Oh, okay. So now I think the statistic flips because they're so conservative that they've been careful and they tend to survive longer.
They do. And I think nationally, while we were like 49th in terms of the number of startups per capita, in terms of the startups or new businesses that survive, we're like fourth best or fifth best, you know, in the top five. And I think it's for a variety of reasons. One is we're more conservative coming into these things. Second is I think people in the Midwest just, in many cases, they just kind of roll up their sleeves and they get it done without a lot of drama. And, it's interesting. I grew up in a small community, kind of a farming community. And not the whole state of Minnesota is farming, clearly. But when you start to get out into the rural areas and you know people that grew up in these rural areas, you know, a farmer works from 5 a.m. to 10 p.m. And, you know, they just, and it's not easy work. And I remember as a kid when I was 14 years old, maybe I was 12 years old, we were 12 years old, our summer job was, it was called hoeing beans. And they don't even do that anymore. They don't even hoe beans anymore because Roundup has eliminated this need. But back then, you'd have to clean the bean fields. And so you would start at 5:30 in the morning, and you would have your hoe, and you would, you know, meet at Billy Bob's house, and the farmer would come, and he would pick up a truckload of eight kids or six kids, and they would all hop in the back of the pickup truck, and they would drive you out to the farm, and you'd walk the fields with your hoe and, you know, cut the weeds out of the bean field until like 1 o'clock, and it got too hot, and then you got to go home. So, you know, here's a bunch of 12-year-olds working the fields at 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning, hoeing beans. And we just thought this was just normal.
And probably making $2 an hour, right?
I think we were making $2 an hour. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the point was, you just assume this to be normal. And so I know a lot of friends now that I grew up with, and they tend to be just kind of hardworking, somewhat humble, lean in type of individuals. And I think some of that is true for sort of the state as a whole, where, you know, people just say, okay, I've committed to something. Let's roll up our sleeves and get it done. Now, I speak in generalities. Not everybody is like that, but I think there's a little bit of that tone as a whole for the state.
Well, this is a good transition to, in case listeners or viewers think that you, Michael Peterson, is a really conservative guy. I want you to talk about your car racing and motorcycle racing for a minute.
Yeah, I think this people in the state of Minnesota are pretty conservative. I don't think most people would call me, you know, risk averse, right? That's not really in my DNA. You know, financially, I played naked options in the marketplace. And for hobbies, I race a little bit and teach track school. So no, I am probably not on the more conservative side of risk averse.
But I think this sideline is worth hearing a little bit more about because it'll kind of prove the point. It's like you've taken your capacity for risk to other aspects of your life.
Well, and when I was young, I was in my mid 20s, Jothi, and I think you and I are kind of a similar generation. But when I was in my mid 20s, and this was back in the early 90s, I suppose, I said, oh, I had a buddy who was a big motorcycle an aficionado, and he was building race engines for a lot of the guys that went to the track. And he's like, hey, listen, Mike, we need to go get on the track and go race motorcycles. And I'm 20 and I'm dumb as a box of rocks and I have no fear like most 20-year-olds. I'm like, okay, sounds scary, but let's give it a whirl. And so I started racing in my early 20s, which in some ways is kind of late. you know, often the great racers start when they're 12 or 14 years old. I started in my early 20s. And this is not BMX bikes or dirt bikes. These are the guys running around dragging their knees on the ground. And so I started racing in my early 20s. And I didn't race for many years. I raced for, I don't know, four or five years. And even I was married at the time to my wife, still am. And she said, hey, here's the deal. You can go have as much fun as you want on the racetrack and go get your jollies out and I'll go with you and it's going to be great. But when we have kids, I want your butt off the racetrack. I don't want to have a maimed husband. And so...
Smart woman.
Yeah, exactly. So she let me get it all out of my system. And then I, once I went back to B school and we started having kids, I got off the track. And it was a really good time in my life. And I was racing and I was teaching racing school as well for motorcycles. And it was a really good time in my life. And the one piece that I had, which was unique when I was going to B school and I was not B school, engineering school. I did my engineering research at Purdue. And it was an interesting time because I was working for Ford. Ford sent me back to fellowship at Purdue and said, hey, go smarten up a little bit here, young man. And so I went back full time to Purdue and I did some what I thought was kind of interesting research in simulated vehicle dynamics on the computer, right? How do you make cars go faster using some fairly sophisticated modeling techniques, at least it was back then, in how a vehicle performs. And vehicles have these very funky, weird, non-linear relationships with the road that makes it fun to model, right? It's not a linear relationship. It's very non-linear, which you need to use some weird mathematical techniques to kind of get to the answer. But I knew vehicle dynamics very well. And I had written some papers for the Society of Automotive Engineers and whatnot. And so then when you put me on the track, I'm like a guy from Mars, because most of these guys on the track, they're great drivers, but they're not physicists. They're not deep engineers. They haven't done computer modeling to understand how the vehicle reacts. And so I had this weird blend of being very good technically of what was fundamentally going on from a physics perspective, and I could drive okay. And so when you put me in front of students, I could kind of talk the talk and walk the walk and tell them what was going on. And so I enjoyed that and I became okay at it. And then I got out of racing when I had kids, as I said. And then about 5 years ago, as we started to become empty nesters, I got pulled into a local track here in the Twin City or in the Minneapolis, Minnesota area called Brainerd International Raceway. And I've been teaching with them for a while as well, but it's all been cars, not motorcycles. I think my bones are a little bit brittle now to be bouncing around on a motorcycle when I crash. And so I've been teaching track school for both SCCA and just regular performance driving school. And I really enjoy it. And I think there's some similarities between what we learn on the track and what we learn in business. And I think there's a lot of parallels there. And so I enjoy it because it, you know, gets my blood pressure, you know, my blood moving and my adrenaline up and my endorphins moving. But it's a very, very focused event. And the thing that I miss a little bit, and forgive me, I'm going off on a tangent here, but when you're running a startup, like there's 1,000 things moving and you just, you know, you're trying to keep all of these balls in the air. But when you're an engineer, you'll sit down at the desk for 4 hours and work on a problem and just time goes by instantly. It's a little bit like a surgeon. A surgeon will go into a surgery for 8, 12, 14 hours and be maniacally focused on that particular problem. Right? Fixing that joint, fixing that cell, fixing that laceration. Engineering can be the same way. You're just deep into one particular math, physics, chemistry problem. And I think it's wonderful. We don't have enough deep thought like that in our world as a whole. Everything tends to be instantaneous. When I get on the track, Jothi, time, just you get everything compresses to what I'm doing right here and now. And I'm trying to keep this car totally optimized on the edge, on the track. I'm not thinking about my bills, my business, my wife, and nothing. It all disappears. And it's just a very pure thought and a very, very deep focused thought on what you're doing on the here and now. And you're spending all of your mental energy on that. There's not that many things in the world where you do that on an ongoing basis anymore.
And certainly if you're making sure you protect your life and your you know, your body, you've pretty much got to be that focused. And I mean, I think the same thing is true of some sports, you know, skiing, by the way, in particular.
Yep.
You know, you're skiing down the mountain, and I was just, you know, skiing a couple of weeks ago, and you know, the average speed I go is probably, you know, 30 miles an hour, and you can't be thinking about,
no, you're,
you
right.
know, even if you're worried about payroll the whole time you're riding up the lift, I assure you, when you're going down on the snow,
you're not thinking about payroll anymore, are you?
No, you're not. So all those years, did you ever, you must have had a wipeout or two along yeah. those, along, did oh, yeah. you ever get hurt?
No, not badly. You know, I've certainly low-sided and high-sided a few times. The high side we call a Superman. And, you know, you're leaning over.
You go flying.
And you go, you know, the bike kind of, you know, abruptly stands up. And you go flying off 10 feet in the air and land. And I think that is very analogous to if you've ever water skied. And I don't think you've water skied, Jothi.
I have. I have water skied.
Okay, so when you water ski, if you're going, you know, especially if you're making a carve, at the very end, when you crash on a water ski at high speeds, you just see white water for like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Right? And you kind of get thrown all over the place, and you don't know which way is up. And then finally you go, okay, now everything's stopped, and I float to the surface, and I can, you know, it's done. And when you high side, it's very similar, because you're just getting thrown around like a rag doll, and you're not quite sure which way is up, and you're trying to flatten yourself so you don't toss around quite as much, but you don't have as much control as you think. And sooner or later you stop and you look up and you gain your composure. The only difference between crashing on the water and crashing on the road is when you crash on the road, it hurts every time you hit. So it's like, ouch, ow, ooh, ah, ooh. You know, you're getting hit on your butt and your wrists and your shoulders and everything else. And when you crash on the track, you're likely to break a wrist or a collarbone or, you know, maybe your leg, but you're not likely to die because the track in general is pretty safe. You have a lot of runoff. So you're going to break bones getting tossed around, but you're not going to kill yourself. And you're wearing the proper leather and helmets and boots and, you know, everything else. So it hurts, but it's generally not catastrophic.
I have had
a couple of people that have had bad wrecks that have messed them up and more badly. But I was fortunate I never had a bad crash.
If you're barefoot water skiing, the speed that they try to have you go is 47 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And when you hit the water at that speed, it hurts a lot. I mean, you know, any sport where they say you need to wear padded shorts, a steel cup, and a neck brace, and industrial strength nose clips. You wonder if this is a good thing to be doing.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing, because you're right. When you're going that fast on water, water is very hard.
Yeah, it sure is.
It doesn't move very well.
Well, we're kind of bouncing around a topic I always like to talk about, which is grit. And you clearly have developed grit in at least two important parts of your life, the whole racing and track and startups. And where do you think it came from? I mean, you're not just born with it, you know, you develop it somehow. And where do you think it came from?
Yeah, it's a good question. God, you ask good questions, Jothi. First of all, I think grit is becoming more and more appreciated in sort of the universe of things. And I'm glad that it is. I think it's incredibly important. And it's one of the things that I think, and I know this will be a little controversial, but I think sometimes I'm concerned that the younger generation doesn't have as much grit as sometimes different generations, you know, have. When you go back and you look at generational trends, we often refer to the greatest generation, right? And that's kind of the formal name for them too, the greatest generation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about their life, many of them went through World War One. They went through World War Two. They went through the Great Depression. They're getting shot at. They're losing friends. The whole world seems to be, the deployment of the nuclear bomb. I mean, just all sorts of, well, I guess it wouldn't be the nuclear bomb, but they went through some really difficult stages growing up. And they came out of all of that adversity and they created one of the most remarkable metamorphoses of a country ever. Right? They're putting men on the moon and their industrial revolution and, you know, some really interesting, fascinating stuff came out of the greatest generation, right? And they were not complainers. They were not whiners. They just got on with it. And I think after you've had your ass shot at in the south of France for many years and you come back and you realize I'm still alive, this is a pretty good deal. You sort of embrace the opportunities ahead of you. It makes you appreciate life a lot more. And I think, Jothi, your life as a whole, you've had a couple of curveballs in there, and it's made you stronger, not weaker. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so if you do that to an entire generation, you make them stronger, not weaker. And I think that happened with the greatest generation in many ways, and I applaud that. I think sometimes even myself, listen, I grew up in a small town in the Midwest with, average income, maybe slightly below average income. And we were just instilled hard work with us. And so I think that grit just came from just sort of, this kind of the small town, work ethic that sometimes instilled in you. And I wish we had more of that in society as all. In my opinion, if we had the opportunity to take every kid coming out of high school, and it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, or city or rural, and they were forced to spend 2 years, whether it's the military or giving back through community service or something a little bit like Israel, and I think Sweden still does it, others, where you have to give back for a couple of years, where you force everybody into the pot and you overcome tough adversity. I think that would make us stronger as a whole. But hard times create strong people. And I think sometimes grit comes from adversity. And it seems to me that you're a byproduct of that, Jothi.
Well, I have to strongly agree with your idea of a mandatory 2-year national service. And it doesn't have to be something where you're fighting. It can be something Correct. Where you're building things.
Correct.
It would be great. I don't think it has a snowball's chance in hell of
I agree
of we're both dreaming for the moment anyway. So this you said from the beginning, I want to come back to raise a hood, because it sounds cool. It is going to take a long time. You're a hard worker, you're going to keep at it. What's next? Are you going to work on this for the next 10 years? Because I think you're probably the first to admit it's going to take that long for it to really play out completely.
Yeah, I think, it's a really good question. Right now, I care about one thing is you've birthed something. We've birthed Raise a Hood here. And I want to make sure that succeeds. And whether that means I'm leading it for a decade, whether it means I grow it to a certain point and we bring on somebody else to actually lead it and I just become an advisor or a technical support staff, I'm fine. I don't really care what – I think there's some founders that come in and they say, hey, no matter what happens, I have to be the one leading that. I call bullshit. I think there's so many talented leaders out there, and I certainly don't think I'm the best of the best. And different leaders have different skill sets as well. If I'm trying to do an IPO, I'm probably not the best guy to drive this business through an IPO, right? But my point is, whether I'm leading it or whether I'm a part of it or whether we just, move it on to a new chapter of leadership, I don't care. I just want it to succeed. And we'll let the facts of the time go figure that out. If I'm a part of it for the next decade, it would make me really happy. But I don't hang my hat on the fact that I have to be leading this or I'm nothing. This isn't about me. This is about making the business succeed.
I think it's a wonderful lesson for everybody to hear. I subscribe to the same thing. In fact, my current startup, which I've been essentially building for since 2010, so 14 years, and leading it all that time up until 2022, when I stepped back. And it's been wonderful to step back. Not completely. I'm chairman and I'm involved officially 2 days a week, but it's more like, you know, half a week, I guess, that I'm doing it. Well, I think we've covered a lot. We could go on, but I think we should, you know, say that's it for this time. The stuff was wonderful that we talked about. I really appreciate everything you've said, and it was a lot of fun.
Jothi, I appreciate your time today, man. I appreciate you having me on. It's a good fun to talk to you. I think you got a fascinating background, and I applaud what you're building here.
Well, thank you. That's going to be a wrap for today. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Adventures on the Can Do. Please share and like us on your social media channels. This is Jothi Rosenberg, and I'll be back with a new episode every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Don't forget to check out the show notes for additional resources and links. Hasta la vista.